dice to save the
ship. Welcome back to the Roundtable on WAMC. It's a Friday morning, 9:13. You're listening to a little morning, my morning jacket this morning. They're playing at Mass Mocha on Saturday, massmocha.org for more information. It's the Roundtable panel, and a great panel today. According to my script, well, none of the people on my script are actually here today, so I'll tell you who's here. Judith Enck is here, who is a former EPA regional administrator. Good morning.
Morning.
And also, economics professor at Siena, Aaron Pasitti, is here. Hello, Aaron.
Good morning, Ray.
Nice to have you here. And, oh, one guy who is on the script, WAMC's Alan Shartok. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing good, buddy.
Nice to have you with us as well. The email address here is panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. A couple of ground rules about the letters. And we don't want to sound like we're being very, very strict, but we have so many letters that come in. If you could keep them short and to the point, one good point is better than 17 tough-to-understand points. Just a good short point. Don't write in more than once per day if you can. Don't include links. We cannot click them. Don't use abbreviations. Proofread your emails. Those rules, simple. It's panel@wamc.org, right?
Easy. You sound like a college professor.
Well, you see, now I've finally done something of value in my life. President Donald Trump has issued an urgent warning to North Korea not to move ahead with its ballistic missile testing. He's tweeting this morning, military solutions are now fully in place, locked and loaded, should North Korea act unwisely. Hopefully Kim Jong-un will find another path. North Korea has announced a detailed plan, as we discussed yesterday, of launching a salvo of ballistic missiles toward the U.S. Pacific territory of Guam. If carried out, that would probably be the most provocative missile launch to date. China has reiterated its calls for all sides to maintain calm and reduce tensions. The statement released today does not mention any specific actions China would be willing to take, although some Chinese scholars and state media have called on Beijing to take on a shuttle diplomacy role to facilitate talks between the U.S. and North Korea. China is the North's biggest economic partner and source of aid, but says it alone can't compel Pyongyang to end its nuclear and missile programs. China called again on South Korea and the U.S. to suspend large-scale military exercises in return for the North halting its programs. Foreign Ministry spokesman for China said in a statement that the current situation is complex and sensitive.
You think?
Yeah, I'm glad you said that. The statement says the Chinese side hopes all related parties will exercise caution in their words and actions and make greater efforts to alleviate the tense situation and enhance mutual trust while not traveling the old path of making displays of strength and constantly exacerbating the situation. And then here was an interesting editorial in the Communist Party tabloid Global Times. And I'll quote. It's pretty much an organ of the government. Beijing is not able to persuade Washington or Pyongyang to back down at this time. It needs to make clear its stance to all sides and make them understand that when their actions jeopardize Chinese interests, China will respond with a firm hand. And then it adds, and this is the weird part, China should also make it clear that if North Korea launches missiles that threaten U.S. soil and U.S. retaliates, China will stay neutral. Alan, I'll give this one to you first, because I know you have often clear and concise thoughts on things.
Well, thank you for that ringing endorsement, Raymond. I almost believe it. here's what. Obviously, China has a great deal. You read the line which said that North Korea's principal and probably only trading partner was North Korea. Yes, but think about who else's principal trading partner is China, and that's us, U.S. Abbreviation. That is something they can't give up, and they also know that there is the potential here, since Kim feels that his regime would be in trouble, obviously, if he loses and agrees to do away with nuclear weapons. He feels that would be his end, just as it was with Saddam Hussein and other people who the United States, had made agreements with and some say didn't keep. So there you are. I think China is going to be in a position where they have to be the broker, whether they like it or not. They can't stay neutral.
Right.
If a whole nuclear reign of terror occurs on their border. They cannot, they've got to put a stop to this. And they will if they think they have to.
Aaron Pasitti, the mention of more sanctions, more economic leverage on North Korea. You're an economist. I mean, how much more leverage is there possible to extract?
Not much. Sanctions have a modest effect, usually on the people and not the administration of a country. So, you know, that further impoverishes an already impoverished nation. And whether or not North Korean leaders listen to that or respond in any way of, you know, dismantling their nuclear arsenal is probably not going to happen. But there is an economic component to this that affects the U.S. more directly, and that is the unpredictability of what Trump is saying and how quickly this has escalated just over the past week creates an enormous amount of uncertainty for the U.S. economy and U.S. businesses.
Although it doesn't seem to show too much on Wall Street, the dollar is having some issues.
Yeah, the dollar's
and the market is down.
The market's down, and that's just the initial response. But as this escalates, I think you would see a lot of businesses pulling back investment, investors, you know, shifting assets to safer places with saner governments. So there could be economic effects to the U.S. as Trump continues to escalate.
And let's remember, it's only been a week. So let's
is that
just,
all?
Let's just,
all this happened when I was on vacation?
See what happens. Let's start out with worst vacation ever. So the president and his family go to the golf club just a week ago, and I think the nation was kind of breathing a sigh of relief that we'd have a little bit of break from the psychodrama known as the Trump presidency. So he goes away to New Jersey last Friday. Over the weekend, remember, the UN did a very good thing. I defer to my economist friend here, my new friend on sanctions. But, you know, it was unanimous. The UN coalition came together. We know that one agency, one federal agency, said that North Korea could, they've miniaturized, whatever that phrase means, nuclear
missile.
I know, okay. But I've never used that word.
Okay.
I know what it means. Thank you.
Call me Roger if you wish.
So North Korea, you know, there's confirmation of that from one agency. And then on Wednesday, and there was discussion about we'll know more in 18 months. So rather than waiting for 18 months, on Wednesday, we get the Fire and Fury tweet. One would hope that the president's advisors would urge him to de-escalate. On Thursday, he says it wasn't tough enough. On Friday, this morning, he uses, you know, ready for military action,
yeah,
lock and loaded. So this is all in the course of 1 week.
And, you know, the interesting thing is that when Trump initially said his Fire and Fury comment, when he was meeting with his advisors, he had a one-page briefing, according to the New York Times, about the opioid crisis. And then they're discussing that, and then he goes off script and launches into this North Korea thing. So it was not even part of the agenda they were beginning to, or that
which is not the first time a president has made ancillary comments at an event.
No, but the significance of this is very large.
I tell you what, our underwriting break is locked and loaded, and we'll take one right now. 21 minutes after 9, it's the round table. We'll be right back. Be playing my morning jacket as bumper music here all day on the round table, or at least the first half of the program, my morning jacket, playing at Mass Mocha on Saturday. It's our round table panel, and it is 9:23 on a Friday morning. Joining us today is former regional administrator of Region 2 of the EPA, Judith Enck, and Siena College professor of economics, Aaron Pasitti, and WAMC's Alan Shartok. A reminder that you can write us if you wish. Keep them short, folks. Panel at WAMC.org. We are discussing, as we have been, the latest developments in the North Korean, you don't want to say, I guess we'll call it a shouting match at this point between Kim Jong-un and President Trump. And Judith, you brought up a point in the break that I think is worth discussing.
Sure. So, you know, many administrations have failed to really figure out what's the right move dealing with Kim Jong-un and his predecessors. No question, it is incredibly difficult. But I think the obvious first thing is diplomacy, and that should come much, much sooner than talking about military options. And it's been widely reported that President Trump has not filled many key positions in the federal government. And my goodness, this is really coming back to haunt us now. There are 131 diplomatic posts at the State Department. 86 of the 131 are vacant. And I know people don't like the federal bureaucracy and undersecretary for this and undersecretary for that, but we need an undersecretary that deals with diplomacy and relations on the Korean Peninsula. And really, there's no one home at the State Department other than former Exxon CEO Rex Tillerson going around with a big broom and dustpan trying to clean up the comments of the president.
Now, do all of go ahead, Alan.
I was just going to say, and being widely dismissed by some of the neocons in the White House who were saying he has no business opening his mouth, the Secretary of State. This is defense stuff. This has nothing to do with diplomacy.
Yeah, so,
there's the message.
Yeah, you're right, Alan. Sebastian Gorka's comments, don't listen to Tillerson on this policy. I mean, do you think Gorka is trying to position himself to take Tillerson's place if they force him out?
According to Gorka, we're now a hyperpower. So, I mean, we're going to need more help, clearly.
And anything is possible. I watch Gorka all morning and all night in my spates of being up.
Yikes.
You know, I think the proper academic term about Gorka is that he's a very dangerous man. Because he is so close to the president of the United States. But a better academic term is, what a jerk.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you mentioned all those appointments, Judith.
Mm-hmm.
Are those, now you've been in Washington, are all of those appointments, do they need confirmation?
Yes, these are all Senate approved. And so the White House Personnel Office has to do vetting, and then the person sent over for a bunch of meetings with senators. There's typically a hearing. I will go out on a limb and say if the Trump administration sent a bunch of these appointees over to the Senate, I think both Schumer and Trump's new best friend McConnell would move on it rapidly right after Labor Day.
And in your estimation, the number of positions in the State Department in the Obama administration and in the Bush administration, that was the ideal number. It can't be downsized in any way?
Oh, you can downsize it, but right now it's 131 diplomatic posts. You can reduce it, but there's only so much diplomacy and globetrotting people can do in one day. So Trump seems to want to cut staff. So, you know, cut it to 100, but get these key positions filled.
Isn't it possible that the megalomaniacal Trump, the narcissistic Trump, really truly believes that he is the only one who's capable of the art of the deal and of the negotiation, and he doesn't think he needs those people there. In fact, he thinks they get in his way. And if you put that lie detector cuff on his arm and say yes and no, and he says yes, you get a straight line. He believes that stuff. Not only that, this thing this morning, which some people are describing as being, you know, a joke. He meant it as a joke. We don't really need 700 people over in Russia. It'll save us money.
Mm-hmm.
It's extraordinary what comes out of that guy's mouth.
Yeah, we're going to get to that topic in a little bit. Aaron, go ahead.
I mean, the interesting part about this is that, you know, the Kim dynasty has largely solidified its power over the past few decades by portraying the U.S. as this existential threat. And Trump is playing right into Kim Jong-un's hands by making this threat real. And all that does is solidify his power amongst the people and not diminish it. And I don't know what the plan is for the 250,000 U.S. citizens that are living in striking range of North Korean missiles. The relationships between Japan and South Korea, who are very staunch U.S. allies, this is a diplomacy matter. And when you have a completely unstaffed State Department, There's going to be a lot of carnage if this happens.
The email address here is panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll take a quick break for news. We will get to your letters, and we will get to more topics. We have on the panel today former regional administrator of Region 2 of the EPA, Judith Henk, and Aaron Pasitti of Siena College, and our own Alan Chartok. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. We'll be back. Nine 9:34 on a Friday morning. That's my morning jacket on the round table. Judith Henk, one of our panelists today. Oh, you're a fan, eh?
Yes.
You never knew.
I learned it here this morning.
They're playing at Mass Mocha on Saturday, and alas, you can't go. But still, it's...
I can follow them now.
Right, and massmocha.org for more information. It's the roundtable panel at WAMC, and our panel today is from Siena College, Aaron Pasitti, former regional administrator of Region 2 of the EPA, Judith Henk, and the gentleman coughing is our own WAMC's Alan Chartok. Great expectations, sir. And nice.
Well, I take great exception to that,
nice.
To the idea that I'm a gentleman, but otherwise you're right.
The email address here is panel@wamc.org. We've got a few letters here. A serious question is the subject heading. And this is from Lou. First of all, someone needs to muzzle Trump. He is a menace to humanity. Secondly, what is going to take to legally remove him from office? Is Congress in a position to do so? When will the global good become more important than anyone's political career? I just hope they figure this out before it's too late. Deep sigh. And that is from Lou.
I wanted to speak to that, if I could, Ray, for a moment.
I'll give you a moment.
Big of you. And I mean, you're wasting
time.
30 seconds.
All right. So I do think that it is happening. His attack on McConnell is so stupid that it is and is so self-defeating. He thinks that he's Trump of the corporation who can just say you're fired. One-way loyalty. There's no loyalty that is anybody's owed to him. McConnell has done everything but polish his shoes. And I was thinking of another word, but polish your shoes would be adequate.
You could save another phrase for a little later on in the program too. We'll probably bring this up again because
right.
They've escalated that little war of words as well.
Well, but it's unbelievable. And now, what's most interesting is not him versus McConnell, but the fact that McConnell's people are all speaking up for McConnell. They're not saying you were right, and they are taking him on, and that goes directly to the point of the letter, which is, this is now a decision. Will I be defeated in a primary by an ultra-conservative Republican if I defend my leader who is under attack from Trump? And the answer, apparently, although I haven't added up all the players who have checked in, is no, there are limits on what we can do. After all, these people are sitting around the breakfast table with their wives and their children or their husbands, depending on who they are.
Mistress.
What'd you say?
Nothing. Go ahead.
Oh, I thought you said some.
No, just go right ahead. Continue on, sir.
You're on to the Manafort story already.
Go ahead.
Well, yeah. Okay. So I think this thing is beginning to disassemble for Trump, and as he gets more and more nutty about all of this stuff, they're going to protect themselves because they think they're next on his list. You know, there's a famous story, and then I'll stop, of Stalin. On his deathbed, Khrushchev wrote about it, and everybody came in to the room, and apparently to see him on his last gasp, and his toe twitched.
Ha.
And everybody got very alarmed. Well, there's always that balance,
uh-huh,
because if you're dealing with a guy who has shown himself to be a bit of a madman, then anything goes.
This one is from our buddy Jules, who is a regular correspondent. Subject heading, Crazies in the White House. Good morning, panel. You say good morning.
Good morning.
Bannon believes in Armageddon and the end times. Mercer thinks radiation is good for you and sees nothing wrong with nuclear war. Trump glories in playing the tough guy and saying anything that comes into his head. Crazies all. And that's from Jules. This one's from David, who says, China said they would remain neutral if North Korea attacks the U.S., but you left out that they said they would intervene on behalf of North Korea if the U.S. and South Korea attack North Korea. And I think that's a great point because China has consistently called on South Korea and the U.S. to suspend large-scale military exercises, which is truly in China's interests.
Right.
And that's a huge part. We can't be too Pollyanna-ish about this whole situation. North Korea is still very much a player in China's political scheme.
Well, it depends. I mean, it's a very interesting question. We do know that in the very beginning when, you know, the Korean War and those of us who were around for it remember very well how important the 38th parallel and keeping those borders were to China. And that was for a good reason. They were the left. They were the commies, in quotes. They were the bad guys, according to the United States. But they were who they were. They were unpredictable. But now they're part of the, and Aaron Pasitti might well speak to this, they were part of the exchange, the economic exchange. You can't find a hat. You can't find a pair of shoes. Well, you could, but very few without the word China inscribed on them somewhere. They can't afford to lose us. Now, they would love to do away with certain things like our anti-missile defenses. You know, Reagan was talking about the shield, and we have developed it. And the last thing they want is to be in a position where we can shoot down anything that comes up from either North Korea or from China. So to some degree, there's always got to be that matter of balance. But it's a different game than it used to be.
Judith, you wanted to chime in? Or did you forget what you were about to say?
I'm going to consistently on this topic, I'm just going to say diplomacy. And I think on the economic issues that, you know, all the free traders believed, and I defer to Aaron on this, that you get our economies connected and the nations are bound in a way beyond patriotism, economic survival. I think the China role is fascinating here. But not, you know, we can't outsource diplomacy. We need, you know, cool heads to prevail, and we need to get the president to do one simple thing on this topic, and that is to stop tweeting.
This is from Christy in Amherst, Mass. Subject heading, Trump's statements not off script. Panel, don't you think that this is not one of Trump's random statements? It is completely reckless, but not off the cuff. The alliteration and language is above his level of articulation. Couldn't this be some plan of his advisors, which is not to say that it's not completely dangerous and insane? That's from Christy.
The answer is anything could be possible here. We don't really know, but anything is possible that somebody called in this play, Bannon or Miller or one of these guys that surround the president, anything is possible.
This is from Anne, whose subject heading is, Trump is a brilliant demagogue. Here's my one email with two quick points. Your program is among the best on the radio. Well, bonus points for that one. Number two, Trump may be intellectually stupid and ignorant, but he is brilliant. He is a brilliant demagogue who knows exactly what will fire up his base and possibly unite the country under one flag. War. I think he might be determined to provoke Korea into attacking U.S. territory to replicate what happened after 9/11 when suddenly no one could object to George W. and we were all on the same side. And that is from Anne. Aaron, you want to say anything?
I think maybe this is the time in the program where we have the uncomfortable conversation about Wag the Dog. I mean, we know that Trump has deep problems with the Mueller investigation, with his staff infighting like a episode of Game of Thrones, which apparently Trump yesterday said he's honored by and he enjoys the leaks that they're just working for his love. But, you know, I hate to be the cynical, but I think his gravitation toward creating this crisis over rhetoric, he was responding to Kim Jong-un's rhetoric, I think is, you know, a very aggressive form of diversion.
Well, to be fair, your former boss on his way out the door said, listen, the biggest thing you have to deal with is North Korea. Nothing.
But my former boss
would never
ever have recommended this course of action. And the status quo, while not great, did not bring us to the point where we find ourselves in mid-August here.
And, you know, North Korea does have a thriving black market economy where there's open trade of goods, albeit underground, largely from China. They're seeing movies from South Korea. They're slowly being exposed to what life is like outside of North Korea. And that, you know, I don't know if that's a form of diplomacy, but continuing to introduce those things and waging, I guess, psychological
cultural warfare.
Yeah, exactly. That could slowly diminish Kim Jong-un's power.
But okay, as long as we don't die before then.
Yes.
This one's from Steve, who writes, "Good morning. What if no one will take those jobs?" Talking about the federal government. No job security? Undermined and contradicted on a daily basis by infantile tweets? Don't sound like desirable positions, do they?
That's you know Steve. What? There's always, and Judith, I think, will tell you this too, there's always somebody to, to take those jobs.
Right.
Always.
Right. They may not be competent, but a lot of people want those jobs because you're close to power.
They may not be good people. Right. They may not be good people, but they will always find somebody to take those jobs. That's not their problem. Their problem is, I believe that the president thinks he's the only one who can do all of this, and the other guys are extraneous.
This one's from Bob in Albany, subject heading Gorka. Maybe I'm being unduly optimistic, but I can't believe that even a Republican-dominated Senate would confirm a man with a known neo-Nazi affiliation as Secretary of State. Am I being naive? And that's from Bob. Is he being naive?
I think Gorka doesn't make it. I think he's right. I don't think it would happen, especially now that he's decided to pick on his allies as opposed to his political enemies.
The email address here is panel@wamc.org, and we have a whole stack of them, but we'll get to some more topics in a moment. We'll take a quick break for some underwriting, and then we'll be back with Judith Enck and Aaron Placidi and Alan Chartok. It's the Roundtable on WAMC.
So much going on these days. Forget about instinct. That's not what pays.
That's Judy Thank's favorite band. My Morning
I love
Jacket.
Them. They're so calming.
You like it?
Yep, I'm in.
Leave it rolling, Professor. No, it's 9:46 on the Roundtable Friday morning. It's the Roundtable panel. We'd sit around and play My Morning Jacket or Blossom Dearie all day long if we could, but we have to talk about important things. And if you want to join in, it's panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Our panel today is WAMC's Alan Chartok, Siena College Professor of Economics, Aaron Placidi, and former Regional Administrator of Region 2 of the EPA, Judith Enck. President Trump is brushing off Russian President Vladimir Putin's decision to expel hundreds of U.S. diplomatic employees from Russia. In remarks to reporters, President Trump dismissed Putin's move, saying, "Hey, it would cut down our payroll as the State Department and save a lot of money." It's unclear whether the president was joking. Putin said last month the U.S. would have to cut 755 of its embassy and consular staff in Russia because of new U.S. sanctions. Moscow's move was a long-expected response to President Obama's move to expel 35 Russian diplomats and shut down two Russian recreational retreats in the U.S. The president, that's President Obama, took action following allegations of Russian meddling in the 2016 presidential election. Give Judith Enck first try on this one.
Well, this is such an irresponsible statement. I sometimes you read the words on your computer and you think, is he joking? So I looked at the film a couple times, and I don't think he was joking. And it was just the most bizarre statement at a time in our nation's history when we need strong diplomacy. So this not only affects the 700-plus State Department staff who have been bounced out of Russia, but everyone in the State Department must be shaking their heads. And this just does not bode well and just reminds us all of his bizarre relationship with Russia.
Alan.
Freud said, and I'm fond of quoting it, you know that, Ray, yes. There is no joke. You know, every joke has a meaning.
Yes.
And I think in this case, it does. It brings us back to his basic relationship with the Russians. We know that during the campaign, he talked about what a wonderful guy Putin was and how he was going to be his friend and how it was going to all work out. We jump way forward and we hear from Eric Trump, I believe, who the son who said we get all the money we need for our projects. And then he had to walk that back. But too bad, I believed him in the first case and not the second. And now we have Mueller investigating the whole deal. We have obviously Mueller trying to turn Manafort and turn Flynn. That's what this is all about, because mm-hmm. they are the ones who can supply the information. And interestingly, Ray, I don't want to jump ahead of you, but at the same time he is saying that, it's clear, right, that he has to say nice things about Manafort. He's been saying nice things about Manafort all day long, because he may be afraid that Manafort is going to do exactly what Mueller probably wants him to do, which is to basically throw in the president. Who knows? But I'm simply saying this Russian thing won't go away. It's now in the hands of FBI people, professionals. The president hinted that he thought it was not right for them to go into Manafort's house in the middle of the night. Very unusual, he said. Very unusual. So the Russian thing, no matter what happens on the outside, continues to unfold. When asked yesterday whether he would fire Mueller, he said no. But of course, nobody believes a word he says, because he said no about firing Preet Bharara. He said no about firing Comey. And so here he goes, and he's saying no, which is almost, as they said in the famous novel, the kiss of death.
So Trump said that the U.S. will save a lot of money by having these 755 diplomats out of Russia. Mm-hmm. So I did a calculation. Mm-hmm. So if you assume that each of those 755 people make $100,000 a year, which is generous, that amounts to 0.004% of all federal spending, which is literally less than a penny.
Right.
I mean, this is a drop in the bucket. So,
right. Or not what it costs Melania to stay in Trump Tower.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, I do think he was joking. I do. And I think the Russians and the U.S. have been throwing out diplomats for, since Lenin.
It's an Olympic sport. But to throw all of them out. And I thought it was joking, too. But, Ray, did you look at the video? You have to
see
it.
There is no joke. Hey, if you're throwing out 740 people, I'd like to ask you guys, what's your estimation out of those 740? How many are quote assets on the ground?
Right.
Which we're always talking
most
about.
Of them.
And that's why the everybody knows, both sides know that, and the intelligence community is like, thank you for doing that.
Yeah.
Okay. So if these two guys, Putin and Trump, are as friendly as I think they are, with the Russians, is this a good thing that we're taking 740 people? Another president might say, oh, that's terrible. But he didn't. He said, we don't care about that. Is that something that would be good for both Putin and Trump?
Well, we need Malcolm Nance here for this.
Yes, we do.
He needs to defend the spies.
And I need to discuss this whole acoustic weapon business with Malcolm Nance down in Cuba.
Which they think maybe the Russians did and not the Cubans.
And now a Canadian diplomat also says, I have the same problem.
Yeah, this is above our pay grade.
And by the way, just in case there are a few people listening, which happens all the time.
There are a few, perhaps.
Who have no idea what you're talking about. There is a story that is going around that our diplomats in Cuba had their hearing affected by high decibel or something like that.
Above the range of normal hearing.
Yeah, sonic.
Ultrasonic, let's say.
Right. Murray, on the Murray level.
Correct, sir. And our email address here is panel@wamc.org. And in time leading up to news, we can get to a couple of emails. This one's from Jason. If we deploy a nuclear weapon on a civilian population again, no matter what Kim Jong-un does, we will never be forgiven by the world. We won't even be able to pretend that we are the good guys this time. And that's from Jason in Thurman.
What if Trump doesn't care? In other words, that's one of the things. Yes, Jason's right. But what if, he's beating his chest as he does and looking out and saying, I don't care what you think. I mean, we're the United States. We're the most powerful group in the world. We could do anything we want.
Well, that's when you really desperately need the adults to step in. And I'm just, remember in the beginning of the Trump administration, we were all nervous about this very point. I mean, this is what came to my mind on election night when Trump was elected. So the beginning of the administration, there was this narrative that Ivanka and Jared were going to save the day and be a moderating force. Well, we know that's not the case.
But who put that narrative out there?
Probably Ivanka and Jared. They have a press operation. They have their own press folks in the White House.
I think Ray's right in asking that question. We were also horrified that we needed something that we considered
Yes, we were clinging. We were clinging, but it was a mistake. And so now we are clinging to the fact that the former CEO of ExxonMobil and three generals are going to be the adults in the room and save the day. And I was a little disquieted by Mattis's comments yesterday. He said, diplomacy first, but on the military front, we are ready. It did not seem like he was de-escalating the rhetoric.
Do you think he's a free? Do you think he's a player who can just call it as he said? You can just imagine what those calls are like between the White House and the generals.
Yep.
You know, they're saying we all have to be on the same page, and indeed they've all announced we're all on the same page. And at the same time, you have White House insiders saying that we can't listen to Tillerson at all because he is, you know, he's supposed to be doing diplomacy, as if diplomacy and any kind of war issue don't go hand in hand. It's unbelievable.
This one came from Virginia. If by some miracle we get through this nuclear war threat, I can hear Trump's mantra for the next presidential election, namely, I kept us out of war. I am great. That is from Virginia. Catherine writes, subject heading, Trump and diplomats. You are so right, Alan. Oh, he loves to hear that. You're so right, Alan.
I do.
About Trump and his narcissistic stance that he doesn't need or want people around him who will get in his way. That fits all too well with deconstructionist and small government proponents and keeps us citizens in a stranglehold. And that is from Catherine, who agrees with Alan. This one is from Roger, who may not agree with Alan. Would it be possible to get some analysis from the roundtable without using pejorative phrases such as psychodrama, which is the Trump presidency? We all recognize your left-leaning bias, Rich Honan aside, and that's fine. But could you please eschew laying it on with a trowel? It should be pointed out previous administrations have not done a great job in dealing with madmen in North Korea, which we have pointed out, starting with the $4 billion Clinton gave the regime back in 94. Is it possible, is it not, that intemperate utterances from the White House might just give Kim Jong-un pause and even reverse his policies?
Yes, sure. That's true. That's true. I'll give you that. But what about the other side of that, which is intemperate remarks may lead to nuclear whatever, hell.
And a lot of,
I mean, is that a possibility also?
And a lot of allies of the U.S. citizens' deaths and the Americans that are living there.
I mean, yeah, I don't think actually the media is paying enough attention to the seriousness of this issue. It's kind of being covered, and perhaps us included, as you know, this insight into Trump's personality and why he's doing this. But Kim Jong-un is a very unstable, terrible force in his own country. And the last thing you want to do is force him into a corner with ultimatum. And that is exactly what our president is doing. You know, the president is threatening a preemptive nuclear strike because of Kim Jong-un's rhetoric over the past few weeks.
But also actions. Now, if we go back several months, two years.
20 years.
Missile launches.
Yes.
And everybody saying, don't launch missiles, stop it. And they continue to do it. And then North Korea adds more, we will turn to the U.S. to ashes. You're President Inc. What do you do?
Well, I fully understand the threat, and in no way am I defending the actions, but the military option is not an option here because it's a nuclear option with so many people at risk. And you have to really double down on diplomacy. And you've got to think of things that's not been tried in the past. You've got to de-escalate the situation. I know this is a dilemma. It has been a serious threat and it's getting worse. But I want to completely take the nuclear option off the table. Completely.
Well, that would be nice.
But when
you say
you're locked and loaded and fire and fury, that is the opposite. This is where you need trained diplomats and former presidents and skilled negotiators to deal with our allies, not just Kim Jong-un. I don't think you can reason with him.
Aaron Pacitti, before we take a break, I'll give you the last word, and then we'll take a break for news.
Trump is just solidifying Kim Jong-un's power and the credibility he has with North Koreans, and he's playing right into his hands. And people write off Kim Jong-un as somebody who's crazy, who has no grasp on it, and he's very shrewd. I mean, he hasn't been able to maintain his power this long without some type of plan, and Trump's playing into
it. Well, he did a lot of killing. I mean, that's one way to keep
including
your power.
Including of his own relatives. Yeah.
Let's take a break. It's the Roundtable on WAMC, and the email address here is panel@wamc.org. Aaron Pasitti and Judith Henk and Alan Shartok on the panel. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Roundtable on WAMC. It's 10:05. I'll call it 10:06 on a Friday morning. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. It's the Roundtable panel, and our panel today is Siena College professor Aaron Pasitti and former EPA administrator Judith Henk, along with WAMC's Alan Shartok. And President Trump is officially declaring the opioid crisis a national emergency. Trump made the announcement before holding a security briefing yesterday at his golf course in New Jersey. He told reporters the drug crisis afflicting the nation is, quote, a serious problem the likes of which we have never had. And he's drawing up documents to so attest. A drug commission convened by Trump recently called for a national emergency declaration to help deal with the opioid crisis. Judith Henk, first of all, before we get into the discussion, what actually constitutes, what happens when something is declared a national emergency?
Well, this is a very positive development, because what a national emergency declaration means is it opens up new federal resources. You usually have that after natural disasters and hurricanes. The law in question is called the Stafford Act, and you can tell I'm a recovering federal bureaucrat when
I say— You love the Stafford Act.
I love the Stafford Act. I really do. I used it during our EPA's response to Hurricane Sandy, and then in an unusual utilization of the Stafford Act, President Obama utilized it for the Zika response in Puerto Rico, which proved to be enormously helpful. So it essentially frees up and provides federal disaster recovery funds, and also forces all of the agencies to work together. And you think that would happen on its own, but there's nothing like, you know, a memo from the White House to say, hey, HHS, HUD, EPA, FEMA, you're all going to work together every single day and cooperate. So this is a positive step, and I'm happy to say I applaud President Trump for taking this step.
Alan.
Well, there is that, of course, and Judith is absolutely right. But there's also the politics of the situation. And that is that we had word from the White House that they weren't going to do this. So again, on the spur of the moment, Trump makes an announcement about the opioid crisis after his own White House said it wasn't going to happen. Now, that's interesting, isn't it, Judith?
Yeah, I was skipping over that because I like the end point. You're absolutely right. They had the meeting at the golf club, and that's where Trump folded his arms and talked about fire and fury. And he specifically rejected the recommendation that this be declared a national emergency. And I heard Tom Price, the HHS secretary, describing why it's not a national emergency. And then he turned course the next day, and that's okay.
But he did clarify and said all things were on the table for the president.
I think in situations like this, you just let them out of the corner if they're getting to the right spot. And I hear in this situation, they got to the right spot.
Aaron.
So the opioid crisis is largely a response to economic conditions. So since the mid-90s, you've seen declining mobility primarily for mid-aged white men. A Princeton economist, Angus Deaton and Ann Case, have documented this. And beginning in the late 90s, the United States is the only developed nation with rising mortality rates for white middle-aged men. And that is largely due to what they call despair deaths, substance abuse, alcohol, now opioids. So, you know, the rise in income inequality, declining mobility, stagnating wages, the lack of economic prospects— all of this is contributing to people really just offing themselves.
Exhibit A, West Virginia, and let's not let Big Pharma off the hook in terms of pouring lots and lots of opiates and other prescription drugs into communities. And it's you know, Aaron, I appreciate you pointing this out. It's certainly an issue for adults and also for impressionable children.
True.
You know, teenagers. I mean, my son went to a local high school. He knows a couple kids who have died from this that were in his high school class.
Heroin or?
Heroin, yeah.
OxyContin?
Yeah. Heroin is cheaper than, they start with the pills and then go on to heroin. And, you know, it's and they're from loving families. And, you know, it's just heartbreaking. So we've got to get ahead of this. And this it has to be coordinated.
The trickle-down effect of what was, you know, prescribed for legitimate pains then becomes abusive or abused. And now it's trickling down to more recreational use that is deadly.
So I was thinking about something, as Aaron was just saying, I think brilliantly, what economic class was involved in this. Think about this. As Aaron was talking, isn't it also true that the very people who he was identifying as at most at risk, you know, white, middle-class men, perhaps some of whom do not have college education, these are the Trump voters. Mm-hmm. And it led to Trump's election with their dissatisfaction. So I wonder if there's any kind of equivalency here.
Yeah, I mean... Absolutely. This is a problem that's affecting his base, but the root of it is dealing with economic issues and job prospects and low-cost education and affordable health care, things he seems to be walking further and further away from. That's not to say that dealing with this as a national emergency is not a good first start, but until you take care of the root causes—
right.
You're only going to just, you know, nibble away.
And hopefully getting, you know, having this emergency status, it's not just, you know, hiring more police to arrest more people.
Right.
That's, you know, law enforcement plays a crucial role, but we need a much more comprehensive approach, as you say, that gets to the root of the problem.
Well, you mentioned that you had a couple of your children's friends who died of heroin.
Yeah.
So clearly... be a good idea to get the heroin dealers off the street.
Yeah,
right?
Totally agree. I support law enforcement, but to date, President Trump's response has been to funnel more money into law enforcement. I think that's crucial, but that alone obviously doesn't solve it.
Right.
And his rhetoric.
Yes.
I mean, his rhetoric has been get tougher on the drug dealers, which we all believe in. I mean, who wouldn't believe in getting the kingpins? But, you know, when you're talking about billions, maybe trillions of dollars in the end in terms of all of this money, all of these drugs, there's always somebody who's going to take that risk.
The war on drugs just hasn't worked. Supply eradication, all it does is drive up the prices and enrich whoever the kingpins are.
So you
take
down
one.
Legalize?
Yeah, absolutely.
No.
Legalize marijuana.
You legalize heroin?
Yeah.
Bad mistake.
You provide treatment centers and you have ways to... control the supply and the potency. The reason why people are dying from opioids is because it's laced with fentanyl and cetafentanil and all of these other things. Nobody knows what's in them, and you should treat it as a public health problem as opposed to a law enforcement problem.
You know, Charlie Rangel, ex-congressman, has been talking about this for years, and he knows it's his constituency that has suffered so terribly with this problem. And, you know, we have talked about methadone for years.
Mm-hmm,
I wrote
mm-hmm.
the first thing on the methadone mm-hmm. clinics in New York State, the rest. It is something that just the sale of this idea to people that you should legalize drugs is something, Aaron, as much as I agree with you, and I think you're exactly on target, I just think it's unpalatable for most Americans.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I understand that. That's a pie in the sky idea.
But you're not wrong. It's just that you can't sell it because the first day that some guy dies or some kid dies from having ingested legally sold drugs is the end.
The email address here is panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Judith Enck is here, and Aaron Pasitti and Alan Shartok. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. This one came in from Tommy. Question for Judith. What can we expect to see out of Trump's Region 2 EPA? Anything to be concerned about?
Lots. Yes. He's not yet named a regional administrator, which is not unusual. I didn't start until December 1 of Obama's first year. So, you know, EPA is in its worst shape than it's been in its 46-year history. Everything is controlled by Administrator Scott Pruitt in Washington, not only on the climate change issue, but I was just part of a national announcement yesterday where a Washington NGO, nonprofit organization, Environmental Integrity Project, documented that enforcement of environmental laws is down 60% in this young presidency. And so, you know, the EPA staff are pretty demoralized. They go in every day trying to do their jobs. It's hard.
Do you still have contacts there?
I do. And I have an ethics restriction. I can't appear before the EPA on a policy matter.
Really?
Which, yeah. The federal ethics law is pretty strict, and I honor that. But I'm allowed to stay in social contact with my friends, and we typically don't talk about issues. But I am playing the role of a grief counselor with them. Many are looking to leave. And not just, you know, they've offered a early retirement buyout, but some of the newer staff who came to the agency to work on climate change, clean drinking water, cleaning up Superfund sites, reducing air toxics, getting businesses to embrace sustainability, really smart young people who are now looking to exit the agency.
Interesting. And what's stopping them?
A couple things. One is they can't find jobs in the environmental field, and then they're really torn whether they should stay and fight, which I encourage them to do, or should they look for the exit door. But the ones that want to stay and challenge some of these policies have found that all the decisions are being made by Administrator Pruitt, who I describe as the worst EPA administrator in history. The decisions are made by him and his political appointees, and by the time the rank-and-file professional staff, the scientists, the engineers who really know this stuff, hear about it, it's too late.
Alan.
Wow. Well, you know, I've often talked about this, maybe not in line with everything we're saying now, but you know, there was a point at which every college and university, or almost everyone, set up an environmental protection program, an environmental program of studies. And then when those kids graduated, where were the jobs? Well, the jobs could have been with the EPA, no question about it, and many people went that direction, but that wasn't enough. So where were the other jobs? Well, we know, you know, GE was hiring, other people were hiring, and that is a serious diversion of why people went into that field in the first place.
But so-called green economy is allegedly growing.
Renewable energy is growing.
Yeah.
Alan,
now
it is. I think it's good for trained environmental professionals to go work at GE and Google and power sector companies, because they can explain, you know, what are the details of the Clean Air Act. And if, you know, consumers look at the environmental footprint of a company, and smart companies are integrating that into their economic decisions now. And you're right, you can go work at the EPA or a state agency or a mayor, for instance, and work on zero waste or renewable energy. We need to get to 100% renewable energy, in my view. But having these smart young college graduates going to the private sector is also a good thing.
Yeah.
No, I think you're probably right, although I don't think it's that easy to go where the bottom line is profit.
Yes, it is. They struggle there. I hear from them. It's easy if you go in as a vice president for blank, but when you're, you know, 23 with an engineering degree and you say, I'm recommending this, and yes, it'll cost another $2 million, they're sometimes laughed out of the room.
Sit down, Sonny.
Yeah.
This one came in from Reed, subject heading, Trump's delusion. Alan is spot on about the Donald's foreign policy strategy. He trusts no one but himself to deliver the nation's message. Having been a born and raised real estate developer, he has learned to trust no one but close family members and assumes the presidency can work the same way. What's disturbing is how much the saber rattling resembles the prelude to the Iraq War, when George W. Bush trash-talked himself into a corner where he'd look like a wimp if he backed down. And that is from Reed. This one is from Wendy. An independent from Chicopee, saith Wendy. The line of succession following an impeachment could be worse than what we have. What power do average citizens have left in the face of the rampant dismantling and sabotage? Give us immediate action steps. Thanks, panel, for helpful information, discussions, and viewpoints. Anybody
want
to weigh?
I think we ought to talk for just a second about this. There is an assumption you know, that that we don't have the 25th Amendment, that we don't have a succession, which used to be, you know, the two top guys in the Senate, the House and the Senate were first and second. I'll never forget JFK and those two. I'm an old guy now, so I hesitate to use these terms. But those two fossils sitting up there, you know, in the Congress, McCormick and Carl Hayden, who had been the sheriff of Tombstone, Arizona.
Wow.
Sitting up there. And when asked, would they assume the presidency? They said yes. But that's all been changed now. We saw it with Ford. Nixon appointed Ford. Ford appointed Rockefeller. That's the way it changes. Now, it could be worse and it could be better. Because obviously, Pence would be there. Who would Pence appoint to come in? Who could be ratified by the Congress? It's ugly, but that's the way it would work.
Yeah, coming to a White House near you, maybe President Pence, and I certainly disagree with many of his policy positions, but I have to think he's a little bit more stable. Now, you will get letters.
Who's more stable?
Pence. I think Pence is more stable than Trump.
I agree with Judy.
And if Trump leaves, let's hope Bannon leaves. Because, you know, you look at all the fights on the inside. Bannon is last guy standing. Bannon is now taking on H.R. McMaster. He took on Priebus. He took on the Mooch. You know, it was just 2 weeks ago we were talking about the Mooch.
He was on Saturday Night Live last night. Yes. I don't know if anybody saw that.
I did. Yeah. It was good.
Very impressive.
But I think Bannon is kind of the connecting tissue on a lot of these problems, including fire and fury.
We'll see how he makes out with the new chief of staff, who apparently is not a big fan.
Yeah, but I think Bannon is prevailing with John Kelly.
We shall see.
I mean, we did have 48 hours of, will John Kelly bring some stable professional leadership to the White House? And after this week, I'm ready to say no.
I mean, Kelly can marginalize Bannon, whether or not he gets rid of him. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
This has all happened so fast. There has been so much talk on every cable network and on this program for over a year about all this. I think we can forget that this is so early in the Trump presidency.
Yeah, yeah.
Everything is happening at rapid pace.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or it may be so late in the Trump presidency.
Ah, you make a point, sir.
The presidency is supposed to age the president and not the population.
Yeah, but the country is aging, not the president.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, this is, this one is from Andrew, and we only have a minute here, so we'll limit our comments on this one, and then we'll call it a day. The subject heading, President Coward. Good morning, panel. As a veteran, it boils my blood to see the president, or as our writer says, Trump, addressing our troops, or even when he salutes the Marine guards as he departs Air Force One or Marine One. He's a coward, fake bone spurs deferments, yet as the commander-in-chief, he's unstable and must be removed from power. I blame the DNC for this. Hillary Rodham Clinton was not a good candidate. Hindsight is 2020, but the election is over. What are the Democrats in power now actually doing to save our nation and remove Trump? They always do things by the book. It's past time to take off the gloves. Our democracy is at stake. And that is from Andrew in Middleburg. And so I give each person 10 seconds to sum it up. Judith.
Well, strong message from a veteran. Thank you, Andrew. I think he speaks with credibility. And I'm not going to get into whose fault it is that Hillary won or lost.
Okay.
But, you know, Hillary did say the only thing standing between the apocalypse and, and you know, is her.
Okay, well, that was 20 seconds, so no one else gets a chance. That's it for the panel. That's it, Chartok. You're done for the weekend. Thank you very much to Aaron Pasitti and Judith Henke and Alan Chartok. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.